The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The teaching of intention primarily connects with the teaching of karma. So that's the prime topic I want to talk about tonight, the teaching of karma. So the teaching of karma is primarily about how intention infuses our lives to create the conditions and the results of our lives. Essentially, karma is essentially an ethical teaching. It's a teaching on ethics, in which basically the understanding is that when we act with an intention, so here comes the concept of intention again. If we act with an intention that is skillful, an intention that is wholesome, that is motivated out of kindness, of compassion, of letting go. If we cultivate wholesome intentions like that, then our lives tend to move in the direction of happiness. And if we act out of unskillful, unwholesome intentions, out of greed, out of aversion, out of delusion, out of ignorance, then our lives tend to move in the direction of suffering. So this is a very simple simple teaching that basically our actions, it's not only our actions that produce the results of our lives, but the intentions behind those actions. So this is a key distinction here, that intention is crucial in terms of how our actions produce results. The same action, and I think I talked about this with respect to generosity, the same action of giving may be motivated out of, wanting to get something in return, or it may be motivated out of wanting to connect and to offer something freely. So the intention behind our actions is kind of where the karma is understood to be. In fact, that's how the Buddha defined karma. He defined it as the intention that goes with our actions. So the teaching of karma is that basically our actions produce a result based on the ethical quality of our intention, where the ethical quality is defined as essentially what leads towards happiness or what leads towards suffering. So this teaching of karma is understood to be a natural law. It's a natural law, like the law of gravity is a natural law. So this isn't something that the Buddha made up as, these are a set of rules that are useful to follow. Behave this way, act this way, and you'll be happy. He understood and he discovered in his own experience that I want to use the word law. I guess that's a good enough word because, we use the word law for gravity. The law of how we behave with our intentions is, it's just the way nature is, that when we behave out of skillful intentions, we'll become more happy. And when we behave out of unskillful intentions, we tend to move towards suffering. So he understood this to be just a very natural law, like gravity is a law. If we all understand gravity, if you want to put something in the air, it doesn't work very well. We understand that the law of gravity isn't something that we can just, say, well, what are the exceptions to the law of gravity? How can I put something in the air? Maybe if I if I let it go really softly, it'll stay in the air. No. So like that, the law of karma is not something that, you know, it's not something that we can just say, oh, well, you know, I don't believe that, so that won't impact me. It's like if we don't believe the law of gravity and we walk off the edge of a bridge, we're going to fall off the bridge. It's like that. It's just embedded in the nature of the universe, the nature of how our minds work. So from the standpoint, actually, you know, the definitions, in effect, the definitions of what's skillful and what's unskillful come out of this natural law. This natural law that says, basically, you know, what leads us towards suffering, what makes us struggle, what makes us unhappy, versus what leads us towards happiness, what leads us towards freedom from suffering. So karma, this term karma, is about intention and motivation. So the intention behind, the intention that we act, we take an action out of intention. Every movement that we make, every act that we do has an intention behind it. And with that intention comes some kind of a motivation or a reason why we're doing it. And it's that motivation joined with the intention to do something. It's the motivation actually that is the place where that ethical intention, that ethical spin comes in. So it's kind of like, you know, if you've got a soccer ball and you kick the soccer ball from this side, you know, the soccer ball is going to tend to go that way. If you kick the soccer ball from the left side, it's going to tend to move to the right. If you kick the soccer ball from the right side, it's going to tend to move to the left. So that's, you know, just the natural law of physics there with that soccer ball. So there's the intention and there's the impulse of the leg swinging. And then there's the result, which is the fact that the ball moves in that direction. So we have the intention, the which is equivalent to the swinging of the leg, and then the result, which is the consequence of that intention. So the understanding is that with intentions of greed, aversion, and delusion, then the directionality there, the direction that we tend to go, is towards suffering. If the intention is more wholesome, then the direction that we tend to go is towards happiness. But that this is not a deterministic teaching. So, for instance, you know, in the soccer ball analogy, you know, if you're kicking the soccer ball from this side, if you're kicking the soccer ball from the left, and the wind is blowing really strongly against the direction that you're kicking it, then if the wind is strong enough, you know, no matter how hard you kick it, the ball may tend to go the other way. You know, the directionality of the ball is going to be shifted by the conditions in the world. And it's something like that with karma as well, that our intentions kind of head us in the direction. So the intentions behind our actions, our choices, the intentions behind our choices head us in a particular direction. But the consequences of that, how that manifests in our experience, is going to vary depending upon the conditions. Primarily the conditions in our own mind. So I'll give you some words from the Buddha. He says, there's a case where a trifling evil deed done by a certain individual takes him to hell. Then there is the case where the very same sort of trifling deed done by another individual is experienced in the here and now, and for the most part barely appears for a moment. And so this is expressing the fact that this is not a simple, you do X and Y happens. There is a cause and effect understanding around karma. Karma is basically a statement of, the causes of greed, aversion, and delusion tend to cause the effect of suffering. The causes of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion tend to cause the result of moving us towards happiness, away from suffering. So this is a cause and effect understanding. And yet this cause and effect relationship isn't as simple as, do X and Y happens. So, the kind of a classic thing perhaps would be, if you're a murderer, you go to hell. That kind of very simplistic, deterministic kind of statement. That's not the way the understanding of how karma works. So the understanding is that if the mind it has kind of a direction or a breeze, a wind, a climate of wholesomeness in it, then unwholesome actions, there will be consequences of those unwholesome actions. It's like if you're basically a good person, you're basically doing things wholesome, doing kind things and compassionate things, and if you're basically in that mode of acting, if you do something, like tell a lie or something, you're going to feel the consequences of that. There will be some repercussions of that. And yet it may not be as strong as somebody who's continually engaging in unwholesome actions. The result of somebody telling a lie who's continually, engaging in stealing and robbing or killing, and if they tell a lie, it may rebound very strongly on them. So that's part of the understanding around karma, that it's not deterministic. It really is much subtler than that. There's so many different causes that come together to make our experience. So the Buddha offers an analogy for this. I like this analogy. It kind of helps to make it a little clearer. He says, suppose one were to drop a salt crystal into a small amount of water in a cup. Would the water in the cup be salty and unfit to drink? It would. If you put a teaspoon of salt into a cup of water, it becomes undrinkable. But if you put that same teaspoon of water in a large pond of clear, clean water, if you take a cup of water out of that pond, you're not going to taste the salt. It's not going to contaminate the pond. And so the climate of our minds has a big impact on how the results of our actions are experienced. I think I've told this story in here before, but I'll tell it again because it's such a clear teaching from the time of the Buddha on this, this teaching and how this works, or the understanding of how this works. In the time of the Buddha, there was a mass murderer. How many of you have heard me tell this story? A few, okay. His name was Angulimala, and the name Angulimala is a kind of a gruesome name. It means garland of fingers. And he was collecting fingers of his victims and stringing them on a necklace and wearing them around his neck. So that's why they called him Angulimala. He had killed 999 people, had 999 fingers hanging around his neck. And at that point, he met the Buddha. Actually, the Buddha kind of did an intervention. He knew that he was going to kill his mom, His mom was coming in his path, and he was so lost at that point. He was like, oh, I just need to get another finger. I want to get to 1,000, and it's my mom, but it doesn't matter. And the Buddha realized this is not a good thing. So the Buddha intervened. He put himself in the path of this mass murderer and did some kind of perceptual shifts in Ngulimala's mind, so that it made it seem as though the Buddha was walking very slowly and Ngulimala couldn't catch up with him. And this got his attention. You know, he couldn't catch up with him. He'd been able to beat and catch anybody he'd wanted to catch till this point. And he couldn't catch this slow-walking older monk. And so he finally, in exasperation, called out, "Stop!" And the Buddha turned around and said, "I have stopped. It's time for you to stop." And that also got his attention, because the Buddha hadn't stopped walking. And so he wanted to understand, "What do you mean that you've stopped? You're still walking. I'm the one that stopped." And the Buddha said, "I've stopped living my life through greed, aversion, and delusion. And you live your life nothing but greed, aversion, and delusion. It's time that you stopped living that way." And so Ngulimala, you know, became a disciple of the Buddha. And as good Buddhist stories go, he ended up becoming fully enlightened. Now, you know, I can only imagine what his meditation must have been like. It's you know, it's said that he, you know, meditated for quite some time before he became fully enlightened. You know, I know that for myself, when I've done anything the least bit off, it comes back to me in spades in my meditation. So, you know, he relived some of his, he suffered from his actions through his meditation. But the understanding is that, you know, he was completely freed from his tendencies towards greed, aversion, and delusion. So it's possible, even with that kind of negative action in your life, in your past, even with that degree of negativity, to turn your mind. Part of this points us to the present moment, because that is what Ngulimala did. He turned his mind to the present moment, to just what is happening here and now. And that understanding begins to free us from the intention the wish to act out of those intentions of greed, aversion, and delusion. So in the understanding of this teaching, there's a couple of pieces that I'd like to point out. One is that after Ngulimala became fully awakened, after he became one of the arahants, he still suffered some of the consequences of his previous actions. When he would go off for alms rounds into the village, when he, you know, they remembered who he was. They remembered that he had murdered, you know, their brothers, their fathers, their sons. And they didn't like him very much, and they weren't going to offer him any food. And they threw things at him. They threw clods of dirt and rocks and sticks and things at him. They wouldn't kill him, because the understanding is that it's really, really bad karma, unwholesome karma, to kill somebody who's fully awakened. And so they weren't going to do that. But they threw things at him, and he'd come back, you know, with bruises and with cuts and blood streaming down his face, and he'd tell the Buddha what happened, and the Buddha said, you know, bear it. You're suffering minor results now for what you might have burned in hell for a long time. So the understanding is that the consequences will come to you of your actions. But Ngulimala had turned his mind. So the consequences had a different impact than they would have had he continued killing people. The other reason I like this story is because it points out that, you know, redemption is really possible. I mean, a mass murderer at the time of the Buddha became completely free and lived in peace in his heart after he became awakened. And anything that I've done kind of pales in comparison. So, you know, it kind of inspires me to remember this story, that this freedom, this waking up is possible for us. It really just takes commitment and dedication to turn our attention towards our intentions. The understanding is the intention that leads us towards the suffering or the happiness. And so it's the intention that we kind of need to keep our eye on. You know, our choices are made in the present moment. And if we are mindful in the present moment, we have the opportunity to see what the choices we're making are and what the motivations are of those choices. If we're mindful, we have that opportunity. If we're not mindful, then our habits are generally kind of taking over. Our habits are choosing for us how we act. You know, the way that we've cultivated our minds through our whole lives, we all have various habits and tendencies. You know, one of my strong tendencies was anger. Another one was self-hatred. And when when I wasn't mindful, those were the tendencies that I tended to act out of. And that was how I behaved in the world when my mind was not, when I was not present. But as I began to pay attention to my experience, I began to see that these actions of choosing what to do. I mean, I remember at one point I was so angry I kicked a hole in my boyfriend's wall, you know. So you know, that kind of thing, you know, that intention to lash out like that, you know, we can actually see that before it happens and, you know, do an intervention in our own minds. Decide, do I want to do this? Do I want to act out of this anger? Or do I want to refrain from that action? So it's the intentions that we need to keep our eyes on. So another bit that I want to mention about karma is that so there's the cause and effect relationship, but the effect may not happen instantly. You know, and I think you have all seen something like this in your lives. You know, you do something, and then the effect of that, you know, there can be some immediate effects, obviously, when we take some kind of an action. But there can be other effects that are not felt for quite a long time. So, for instance, if you tell a lie to a friend, there may be some immediate effects in your experience. Depending on what's going on for you, you might feel agitation, or you might feel guilt for having told a lie. Or, you know, depending on what's going on, you might feel relief that you've managed to get out of saying something that, you know, that you didn't want to say to this person. But then if, you know, 2 years later, this friend finds out that you've told a lie, you know, at that point, there may be some other consequences that happen. And so this is another piece of how this law, this natural law of karma works, that the consequences of our actions can happen immediately, or they can happen much later. So this makes this whole field of karma, this whole field of our actions, our intentions, our choices, and what the results of those might be, makes it kind of impossible to work out. You know, if you're going to try to figure out, well, if I act this way right now, what are the consequences of that going to be? And the Buddha said that this, the workings of karma are imponderable. That if you try to figure out all the ways that all the conditions that come together to create particular results, he says you'll go mad. You'll go mad. So it's like this vast web of conditions that come together. Some conditions that, you know, you have put into play, and some conditions that others have put into play. There's one situation where I really saw how these interplaying conditions and choices come together. And that was on one retreat. I was staying in for a month in Spirit Rock. I was on a month-long retreat. And halfway through the retreat, there were a few people that came. So halfway through the month, 2 weeks in, a few more people, I think 5 or 6 people, arrived, and 5 or 6 people left. And I had been doing my meditation primarily in my room, and having had quite a bit of problems in my back, I was doing mostly lying meditation and needed something soft to lie on. So I had this foam pad on the floor in my room where I would do my lying meditation. And I came back from lunch midway into this retreat and opened my door, and there was somebody sitting in my room. She was sitting on the mat on the floor. And then I thought, I must be in the wrong room, and I closed the door. I looked at the number. I was like, no, it's the right number, and I opened the door again. And she said, this is the room they assigned me to. I said, well, there must be a mistake. And she said, no, this is the room they assigned me to. And she said, I figured the retreat must be full. I mean, there's this pad on the floor for me to sleep on. And I said, that's my meditation spot. You know, I put that pad there. So, you know, so there were a couple of things that happened. You know, the first of all, the manager who had written down the note for her had written it down wrong, had told her the wrong number. And, you know, she had come. You know, I had been using this pad on the floor. And she had come with this complete openness and willingness to accept what was offered, and was willing to move into this tiny little room. These rooms are, you know, like 8 by 12. Move into this tiny little room, into a mat on the floor. So if I had not been having the back problem and didn't have the mat on the floor, if she had not been so willing to accept what was offered, if the manager had not made a mistake, any one of those conditions changed, that situation wouldn't have arisen. And it was just kind of amazing to me to see how, you know, all these conditions, and those are just 3 minor conditions that came together, you know, but it really kind of pointed out to me how much conditions come together to create our experience. Now, in that case, I wasn't, you know, I didn't get angry in particular. I mean, I was just like, wow, this is really interesting. So, the workings of karma are quite elaborate. And so while they're a natural law, they're not quite as easy to define as gravity. You know, gravity has a nice equation to it. We can write out the equation and say, you know, here's how fast things will fall, here's when they'll reach their terminal velocity, you know. So it's not that simple. Karma is not that simple. There's these basic principles that, you know, acting ethically will take you in the direction of happiness. Acting unskillfully, in unwholesome ways, will tend to take you in the direction of unhappiness. And these conditions will play out somehow. You know, it's not. I was teaching a class recently, and we were talking a little bit about wise speech and wise action, and, you know, the some of the precepts that we engage in, you know, not killing, not stealing, not lying, And somebody asked, well, what are the exceptions around killing? Suppose I've got termites infesting my house. Is it okay to kill the termites? And, you know, the way this law of karma is understood to work, there will be some consequence of that. It's not that we can just, say, oh, okay, since they're going to eat up my house and destroy my property, that makes it okay, or that makes it so that I won't have any results. I mean, I think that's what people are thinking when they want to ask, is it okay? I mean, will there be any consequence of killing those termites? The understanding is that with this law of karma, when there's an action of killing, it's almost always, I think, the action of killing, intentional killing, is understood to have a motivation of greed or aversion behind it. Either greed to protect your house or aversion at the termites. So you're acting out of that unwholesome action. Now, the consequences of killing the termites may be felt as a feeling of, remorse or regret around killing the termites, or it could come back to some kind of a stronger result in the future. We don't know. The workings of karma are unknown. There are some kind of understandings about the karmic consequence of killing an insect are understood to be far weaker than the karmic consequences of killing a human being. Killing an insect is nowhere near the kind of, you won't get anywhere near the kind of rebound effect that you do if you kill a human being. But still, there will be some kind of impact. So we can't really think about the law of karma as rules, and what are the exceptions. We can try to cultivate as much wholesomeness in our hearts as we can. And then, that climate of wholesomeness will support us when and if we have to act unskillfully or accidentally act unskillfully or unmindfully act unskillfully. We have this climate of wholesomeness in our favor, the wind going in that direction in our favor. So again, it's not like a cut and dried rule. There's many different, circumstances that come together. So I talked a little bit about mindfulness, kind of being the way that we can start to be aware of what our intentions are. If we're not mindful, if we're not noticing our present moment actions, we have very little opportunity to even notice what our intentions are. And so through the practice of mindfulness, we begin to be able to intervene in making choices, just noticing we're going to be choosing unskillfully. Maybe that's not a thing to do. And the precepts that the Buddha offers, the ethical precepts, are really kind of, behavioral guidelines that help us to recognize when the grosser kinds of unskillful actions are about to take place, so that we can notice, I'm about to, swat that spider on the wall. Maybe I should, catch it and put it outside instead. Maybe I don't have to act out of that aversion to a spider. Maybe I can, gently put it outside instead. So we do have this ability to choose, but it does take mindfulness. It takes awareness to be able to recognize how we're making our choices, what our choices are. So I think I'll stop there and see if there's any questions or comments about this. Yeah.
This is actually an off-cut question about what you said. You made a couple of references when you talked about Buddha, you referenced hell.
I'm sorry, say that again?
A couple of times when you referenced the Buddha, you talked about hell.
Yes.
Did Buddhism actually believe in hell? Did Buddha believe in hell?
There was an understanding in the time of the Buddha that there's actually many realms, several different hell realms and many different realms of heaven, yes. So there's this kind of very great cosmological, metaphysical belief system around that, so yes.
So I tend to think of karma as cause and effect. And in my view, there's sort of a spectrum of it that ranges from the purely physical, you know, the laws of physics, to internal, psychological.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk about that a little bit? Because I don't think that Buddha was necessarily talking about physics.
Yeah, in fact, the commentaries in the Buddhist tradition mention that there's five different kinds, I think. I don't know if I can remember them all. Five different kinds of cause and effect that act. You know, so there's the cause and effect of, physical laws of the environment.
That end of the spectrum.
Yeah. The weather, the patterns of weather, that kind of thing. There's cause and effect of heredity. They made that as a separate one. So, apple seeds produce apple trees, not mango trees. So that's another kind of cause and effect that they talk about. Then there's another one called the cause and effect of how the mind works, which isn't the karma per se, but just the fact that, the way we have this eye, and if the eye is functioning properly, sight will come into the eye and seeing will happen. So that's not so much that's not an intention so much as it is just, the natural workings of the body in that way. So that's actually considered to be a separate one from karma. And then there's the karma, which is the mental processes, how intention and action come into play. So the law of karma, the cause and effect law of karma, is around our behavior, is the laws around behavior.
Yeah, but behavior and mental processes are not exactly the same.
No, that's true, yes. The mental processes, but the mental processes produce behavior. So it's the mental processes that produce the behavior that the mental processes are the karma. The behavior isn't so much the karma, it's the mental process itself. So the choice that's made, the intention behind the action, is what is called the karma of that action. And sometimes, like if you're sitting there and somebody hits your knee right on a particular spot, it's going to move without an intention. That's more the workings of the body, and that's not the law of karma so much. Because it's not a mental thing; it's a physical kind of reaction. So there are some actions that can happen that aren't motivated by a mental intention.
So really the teaching here is about the mental aspect.
Yes.
It's not even if I lie and then I'll get caught, I'm going to suffer because I got caught.
That's right.
We know that is likely to, or could happen, but that's not really what the teaching is about.
The teaching is that our intentions have effects. So it's not so much about, if you lie, you're going to get caught and be miserable. It's just the teaching around, like, the natural law of gravity. It's just trying to describe what's going to happen when we behave in certain ways. When we behave motivated out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it tends to take us towards happiness. That's my understanding, that it is, it's basically the understanding of karma is just the understanding of a natural law, and then we use that understanding to help us learn. We can't, put things in the air. We use that law to understand how to become happier. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So my understanding is that, there's cause and effect, and then there's the teaching about intention, and it's consequences.
Yes, I mean the cause. So the cause and effect is broader.
Yes.
Yeah, cause and effect is broader.
This particular
teaching of karma is much more specific.
The Buddha really defined karma as intention or the result of intention.
So this is a good clarification, actually. So karma is the intention. So he says, you know, karma, the word karma means action. And there's one statement where he said, what I call karma is intention. So he says that the karma is the intention. So the karma, you know, this is a way I think that the terminology, the way we've used this term, the term karma is like in, you know, everyday use, right? And mostly the way people use the word karma in everyday use, it means the result. They say, oh, that's your karma. You know, you're not happy right now because it's your karma. And the result that has another term in Pali, it's called vipaka. So kama vipaka. So there's kama, which is the intention. And then there's the result of that, which is the vipaka. So the karma is that, it's like a seed. The karma is like a seed. You know, if you plant a seed, that seed may eventually sprout and turn into a tree and yield. You know, so say you plant an apple seed, you know. If that seed lies on dry ground, you know, it may take a very long time before it sprouts. You know, here in California, if an apple seed fell on the ground in July, it's not going to get any water until December. You know, so it's not going to do anything for a very long time. So, you know, that intention or that intention can be planted without necessarily yielding results for a while. And yet, you know, come December, the water falls, the seed gets some moisture. Over time, it grows into a tree and produces apples. You know, the term I think often used as a result of karma is the fruit of karma, and I think it's because of this. You know, this analogy. You know, it's a very apt analogy, the seed analogy. So the karma is like that seed. It's got the capacity or the potential to produce a result. What result it actually produces depends on the conditions. So it depends on how much water it gets, when it gets the water, how much sun there is, whether there's a lot of wind blowing that seed around. So there's a lot of other conditions that come into play. That seed is the capacity, it's the kind of the direction or it's the possibility to move in a particular way. And you know, the understanding is that all of those seeds eventually sprout in some form or other. But the, you know, that little seed may become a, you know, a little sprout and then a bird may come along and pluck it up and eat it, you know. So the apple seeds that fall on the ground don't necessarily produce trees that yield apples. Some of them have different results. So in a similar way, those intentions, the karma is the intention, may have very different results depending on what we do, how we act, etc. Yeah.
This is really interesting. So if I have the intention, if the intention is a negative thought driven by greed and aversion, is that bad karma if I don't act on it?
So, you know, the acting on it is probably the most strongest way that it would turn into consequence. That thought arising in your mind is an action. It's an action of mind, but it's not an action of body. So there's a thought in your mind, and then, you know, so that thought may have consequences in your psyche. You know, you have this thought, oh, I wish that person would just die. You know, and then you realize, oh God, what a yucky thought, you know, and then there may be guilt and remorse and feeling of shame that would be the result of that karma.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Well, I just want to comment on what this fellow just said. I think what's different in what you said, having a thought, is if you don't act on it, then there is no intention to harm. So it seems like the action is the manifestation of without an intention to harm, it's quite different than having a hostile thought or a harmful thought and acting on it is much different karma.
Well, it's definitely different karma, but you know the mind has still produced that thought out of greed or aversion or delusion, and there's some consequence of that greed, aversion, or delusion. Now, it's not as strong as the consequence would be if you, like, you know, killed somebody.
Yeah, well, the intention's entirely different.
I've seen in my own mind, you know, intentions arise like, oh, I just wish that person would just disappear. And then the kind of recognition that intention or the power behind that intention, if acted on, actually, you know, is like where wars come from, you know, actually in our hearts, we all carry those seeds. But if we don't act on them, if we recognize them, you know, mindfulness is a great mitigator. If we're aware of it in time to say, oh, don't want to follow through on that, the mindfulness comes in and really gives us that intention of mindfulness really kind of shifts and turns the ship a little bit at that point. The intention, you know, the kind of motivating intention may have been equally strong, but if mindfulness is present, it can cut that intention off.
Well, the intention to not act out, to me, is...
That adds another bit of karma to the mix, essentially. Yes.
And negative, you know, feelings come up. I don't worry about them because I'm committed.
That's right. That's right.
So I'm not worried if I have negative thoughts as long as I'm, you know, have noble intentions.
Yes. And in fact, you know, sometimes those thoughts come up kind of as a result of karma, you know, as a result of something you've done or said in the past. And if you're just mindful as they arise, it's just like they just wither in the moment. If they arise and you start thinking about them, you know, if those negative thoughts arise and you start thinking about them or latching onto them or thinking you need to do something with them, then you're, you know, generating more problems for yourself. So yeah, I mean, this you know, when things arise, the mindfulness, the mindfulness is our, it's what saves us. The mindfulness is what saves us. It's what allows us to turn.
Good karma.
Yeah. One of my teachers said that mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. So cultivating mindfulness is extremely good karma. Yeah. Yeah, and there was one over here. I want to get over here, and then we can come back over here.
I have a little bit of question here about individuality and karma. Well, specifically, I was thinking when we were listening to the discussion here, you know, I'm thinking about in the Old Testament, they had a concept, if you go back to the early writings in the Old Testament, that essentially when a person behaved properly, it was for the good of the people around him, his community. No, the implication was that the person's behavior affected not just him, but all around him.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the karma essentially had an impact on the society, not just on the individual. So getting back to my question that relates to this is, to what extent is karma an individual concept? No, it's my karma because this is what I intended. Or to what extent has it become a community? Or this is a community is going to suffer because of my intention, or the community is going to grow better or happier or whatever because of my intention.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a hard question. You know, I'm not quite sure how to answer this question. There's some, you know, I think that the teachings as I understand them from the Buddhist texts talk about the karma being an individual's intention. You know, but that has massive ripple effects out. I mean, the intentions that Hitler had had massive ripple effects out in society. So, yes, our actions do more than just impact us. They impact the world. And so they can, you know, certain people, if people have a, you know, a certain amount of power, then their intentions and actions have a stronger impact on the society. Now, that there's another question, you know, sometimes people ask, well, you know, is it like, you know, is there some kind of group karma? You know, like everybody in this place is subject to, like, you know, kind of feels in a way like, you know, the United States is in a way suffering the results of so much greed of taking oil from other countries, you know, of that there's some repercussions that are happening to the country as a whole as a result of the kind of widespread overuse of energy in this country. Now, is that a group karma or not? The Buddha doesn't address that question. You know, we could look at it as this is kind of the vast network of karma that is said to be imponderable. You know, let's not drive ourselves mad trying to figure that out. You know, our own happiness will be cultivated as we act more skillfully, and other people will benefit as we act more skillfully. So that's what we have some say over. That's what we can do. So if we can, you know, start there. You know, if everybody in the world decided, I'm not going to kill people anymore. I mean, leave aside termites. You know, I refuse to kill another human being. If everybody on the planet decided that, what kind of a different world would this be? You know, I mean, it would be amazing.
Well, what do you do in the case of Adolf Hitler, who's slaughtering millions of people? And I mean, how do you stand by and let that happen?
Well, you know, I think that's the kind of, you know, the big question. And again, you know, there is some understanding around so different gradations, right? I mean, so there will be some consequences. The person who dropped the bomb on the bunker that killed Hitler, there's some repercussions for that. You know, some kind of repercussions. But the understanding, as I said, you know, there's kind of gradations of understanding of the consequences, much less consequence if you kill a bug than if you kill a human being, and much less consequence if you kill an evil human being than if you kill a really wholesome human being. So,
well, that's a good
thing. So there will be some consequence. And I can imagine, you know, there's an understanding of this in the way police departments are put together. You know, when somebody has to kill in the line of duty, you know, even if that person is coming at them and trying to kill them, you know, they understand there's some consequence to that. You know, they need to take some time off for that. Mm-hmm. You know, it has an impact on the psyche.
Right. Sure.
So, you know, it's... That's the teaching of karma, that there is that impact. And sometimes we need to, you know, bear the consequences of that impact, depending on, you know, what the situation is. You know, if I had been in Germany at the time of Hitler and protecting a Jew in my attic, and a Nazi comes and knocks on my door and says, "Do you have any Jews here?" I think I would lie. There will be consequences for that, you know, some repercussions for that. But there's also some wholesome intention there that, you know, mm-hmm. So like I said, you know, the web of karma is vast, the network of karma. So it's not deterministic. It's not like lie and you get these consequences or kill and you get these consequences. That's much more complex than that.
I think for me it would have been very hard if I had a gun in my hand and Hitler was there. I knew what he was doing. I don't think I could have resisted. And I probably have a lot of bad karma as a result of that. But in my own mind, I also look at that as a good act.
Well, there you know, is some of the intention of relieving the suffering of many beings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's got mixed motivations.
Yeah. Yeah. Very complex.
So we need to stop. Yeah. It's after. And I thought for next week, actually, I would like to take questions.